lifespan, habits, and unique anatomy, which allows for a clear, loud call. Listen to the audio to hear the sandhill crane yourself.
Ah, the sound of spring. The sandhill cranes are soaring in the thermals above us right now, trumpeting their call in Skeena region to stop and look up. These beautiful cranes are among the largest of North American birds, standing over 1 meter tall, and they have a wingspan of about 2 meters. What makes the sandhill crane unique? Birds. Over thousands of years, they've evolved elaborate courtship rituals and a wide array of vocalizations. The flight behavior of cranes differs from that of swans and geese. During migration, which is largely by day, and during sunny weather, flocks of a few to several hundred birds frequently spiral upward on thermal updrafts, glide or flap for a distance, then spiral upward again. When flying in straight lines, they use a V formation, and distances between rest stops average about 250 kilometers, while their flight speeds range from 20 to 80 kilometers per hour, depending on wind speed and direction. The crane's snapping upstroke and slower downstroke distinguishes them from other long-legged, long-necked birds. Here in British Columbia, we usually see these cranes only during migration. The age-old crane migrations through our province use the same rest stops and occur at the same time each year. Right now, we are lucky enough to enjoy the call of the sandhill cranes. And today I'm speaking with wildlife biologist Sean Sharp, information about the anatomy of these birds, the uniqueness of their call, and also best places to see them in the Buckley Valley.
I'm Sean Sharp, and I'm a biologist, wildlife biologist, and I've been living in the Smithers area on and off since about 1995. And worked at a whole lot of things, everything for the provincial government through private consulting, which I do these days.
Now, we're talking about sandhill cranes today, which I'm very excited about. And we seem to start around, you know, like early to mid-April. What part of their migratory journey are we catching them at?
They're one of the bigger, more obvious migratory. And they spend their winters down in sort of Texas and Mexico and some of the southern states. And they come all the way right up to the Northwest Territory and all across Canada. So they have quite a journey, and they tend to come about the time that the wetlands are opening up in the north. So they start just at the edge of things. Like if you go about 2 hours north of here, there's still not much open water. It's mostly frozen. So they're kind of pushing the envelope, if you like, most years.
Typically, how many would we see passing over us in Smithers?
In Smithers area, we could see tens of thousands. You know, in flocks, just a few days ago, there were well over 1,000 birds in flock. And it's interesting because the flocks are usually collections of families. Like the young birds from last year hang out with the parent birds right up until they reach their migratory grounds for the summer, and then they split up. And but they often don't, the young ones don't breed for probably 5 to 7 years after. So they're not, they don't breed the next year. They're not like some of these smaller birds.
So what's the typical lifespan of a sandhill crane?
Well, they're a long-lived bird. The oldest one, I think, was about 37 years old.
Wow.
Yeah, it's you know, it's kind of a neat bird that way. They, you know, like Canada geese, they mate for life. You know, they're the pairs stick together for a long time, and if one dies, they will remate. But they make this journey every year for most of their lives, and the biggest threat they seem to face really is just wetland habitat, both here and they were endangered and quite threatened in the 60s, but have recovered significantly. And I think the last estimate I saw is they were increasing about 4% per year.
Hear their call, I'm like, I can't without the windows open. So that beautiful trumpeting sound, is that one of the that a sound to travel so clearly?
Yeah, actually they do have kind of a neat anatomy. Their trachea, like the wind, the pipe that lets the air in, basically. Mm-hmm. They have an extra long one that actually can distend into the stomach region a bit, and it lets them get sort of that deeper resonance, and they even get some kind of harmonics and overtones, and that's part of the really spooky sound of their call. But it's a neat bird that way. I don't know if you've ever seen them, you know, on the ground and when they're mating that, but they do this incredible, they jump around and really kind of neat. Their, you know, wings flapping and their heads pumping up and down, and very energetic looking.
Cool. Where
Basically, they mate all across North America in the north, so all of northern Canada, and most every province, I think. Can't remember if they're in all of the eastern. Yeah, and them in Nova Scotia, so they go right through, and then right up into the Northwest Territories, Nunavut, and the Yukon.
If you wanted to spot them, where is to sit, see them landed, not necessarily flying?
Mm-hmm. Well, the spot where most of us have always kind of headed up to watch them is up the Kispiox Valley. Some of the pasture lands through that area, they tend to settle down, and there is a big stopover. Occasionally, even here, I've seen them just west just of the fields as you head out of town heading west. But the most reliable place seems to be up the Kispiox Valley, a few of the big farms. And if you watch them and they do these big spirals on the thermals in front of the mountains and then often kind of descend into the fields nearby just to rest.
What is your favorite thing about sandhill cranes?
Well, I just think they're such a harbinger of spring. I mean, the fact that, you know, when you hear that sound, you know, spring is here. It's not. They often have mixed flocks too, so we see a bunch of other things flying with them, like snow geese and you know, even occasionally swans will be mixed in with the big flocks that are flying overhead. So it really is like, oh, the gate is burst. they're heading north.
Thank you so much, Sean, for speaking with me today.
Oh, you're most welcome.
Hello, I'm Candace Vetter in Embrun, Ontario, and you're tuned into Viewpoints. Follow us on X at Frequency News. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Toronto has an Sakura trees or cherry blossoms across Toronto will be entering full bloom mid to late April. This bloom marks 65 years to the city. Not many of us know or remember that in 1959, the trees were given to Toronto as a gift from the Japanese ambassador, his name was Toru Hagiwara, for helping relocate Japanese Canadians following the Second World War. Since then, multiple donations have been made under the Sakura Project. Over 3,000 trees were crossed from 2000 to 2012 when the project ended. These trees can be admired in High Park, but also in Cedar Ridge Park, Bellwood Park, and Woodbine Park. A full list of the sites can be found on the City of Toronto website. Owen Thompson has been keeping his eyes open for that picture perfect by first having a chat with James Heron, who has been the executive director of the Japanese Canadian Cultural Center in Toronto for 24 years.
What's the cultural significance of the cherry blossoms or the sakura trees?
I guess the sakura is kind of considered kind of a national flower and certainly a national symbol of Japan. Is particularly meaningful because, you know, it marks the beginning of spring and with that a sense of renewal after the winter months.
When it comes to these sakura trees, for anybody who's not too familiar with them, what's so special about them blooming?
Of course, you know, it's beautiful. But I think, you know, from a Japanese perspective, I think it's kind of the ultimate manifestation of a fundamental concept called mono no aware, which I think plays a big part in the Japanese psyche and in terms of the way that the Japanese mono no aware sort of means evanescence, or, you know, the impermanence and transient nature. And so for sakura, again, is a perfect manifestation of that idea, because they only bloom for, you know, 4 to 10 days a year. When they reach the height of their beauty at full bloom, then they fall away. And that is, I think, particularly to the Japanese mind, I think is a really amplifies the beauty of the sakura and makes the experience of change more precious.
When was the first time you ever saw a sakura or cherry blossom tree be in full bloom?
You know, I went to Japan in 1986. I lived there for, I guess, about 11 years. And I'll be honest with you, it wasn't something that was really on my radar before I went to Japan. But when I got to Japan, I got there in February, and the plum blossoms, which are the blossoms that come out before the sakura, were coming out in Japan, and it was again quite spectacular. And that's when I came to understand the importance of the sakura blossom in Japan. And then again in my first year there, I with a number of friends had the opportunity to enjoy hanami parties. And hanami is essentially flower viewing. So that's when Japanese, whether they're groups of friends or groups of co-workers, would gather underneath the trees as they're in blossom, eat and drink and sing. And it's a very festive time of the year.
Toronto has had these trees for a while now. So with the Canadian context, why is it important to go out and see these and have their own hanami parties, which I think people just go out and have picnics under?
You know, I couldn't really say why people have become so much more aware of the importance of the cherry trees. You know, I know certainly that the nature of Toronto has changed, and since I was a boy, you know, it's become much more multicultural and much more, and people are, I think, much more aware of other aspects of the other cultures that we probably quite naturally it came to the fore in terms of people's imaginations.
Yeah, because these trees are now it's kind of a destination city, especially after the long winter or long. My understanding is that the weather in Japan it gets rather humid very quickly. Don't last as long as Canada. For example, here I believe it was snowing up until very late into March. So seeing these trees can be, I imagine, as you mentioned, is a symbol of kind of spring coming.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, the sakura bloom earlier in Japan because it's a warmer country, so it'll be happening later in March or early April. But it's kind of interesting because again, there's people are so aware of the cherry blossom that in Japan there's something called the sakura zensen, which is like a Zensen is like a weather term for a front. So we would say, you know, like, so there's the sakura zensen is essentially the front of cherry blossom blooms as they move up from the south of the country, which is warmer, up through, you know, up to Hokkaido. So, you know, you turn the news on any given night and it'll sort of say that, you know, in Kyoto, the trees are now reaching. So it's tracked in Japan. In the same way as weather might be tracked here, certainly at that time of the year.
So, when you may or not be kind of aware of, you know, as you mentioned, hanami parties or doing these picnics, you're someone who has kind of had experience with that. For anybody that wants to kind of go to the sakura trees in, I guess, a more of a kind of a culturally traditional way to Japan, how would someone go about setting up and enjoying something like a hanami party?
It can be as simple or as complicated as someone wants to make it. I've been to, hanami parties in Japan where, you know, everyone's eating latte and beer, et cetera, and someone's brought a karaoke machine and set up a huge tarp to keep everyone dry. I think if you can just find a nice Japanese bento, try to find a quiet space with some friends and sit down and enjoy a bento lunch and look at the trees. That's really all you need for hanami. I mean, I'm not going to suggest that anyone take sake with them because I'm not sure whether, I guess right now there are certain parks where you're allowed to enjoy an alcoholic beverage, but sake and beer in Japan would certainly generally be part of that experience, but not 100% necessary.
Speaking actually of parks, so High Park, cherry blossom trees here in Toronto, but the Japanese Cultural Center actually also has sakura trees. Are those available for viewing for the public?
Yes. Well, it's, you know, the Japanese Canadian Cultural Center is a public space, you know, in terms of our grounds. Right now, we have about 100 trees. A number of them were gifted to us through a project that the consulate ran, the Japanese consulate ran in the early 2000s, called the Sakura Project. To those trees, we recently received from Shiseido Canada, who planted an additional 70 trees. Yeah, people are certainly welcome to come and visit. Our trees, a lot of them are in Alaska, so they are a little bit delicate, but we welcome everyone to come and see them. We're actually in the process as well. installing a new irrigation system so that, you know, one of the trees healthy through the hot summers, et cetera. So we've invested in a sprinkler system so that the trees will remain many years.
To make sure that these trees remain, you know, fine, especially for the delicate ones, what are some things people should be avoiding doing to the trees?
You know, we always just sort of say, you know, take home in either your your mind or in your camera or your phone, but you know, don't pull blossoms off the trees, don't break off branches, try not to touch the trees. I mean, you know, they're not sequoias by any stretch, so they can be a little bit delicate. So, yeah, see, but don't touch.
Just to kind of touch back on when your time in Japan, how long were you in Japan for?
I was in Japan for 11 years.
11 years. So when you went to Canada for these soccer trees for 11 years, and then coming back to Canada, when you see soccer trees bloom now, are you brought back to your time in Japan?
Yes, certainly. And in fact, you know, I think one of the advantages of as many sakura trees, and how there's so many spectacular sakura vistas in Japan, you know, Japanese parks, you know, tend to fill up with a lot of people. They're, you know, as much as you want to be communing with nature, you know, there's very good chance that there's could be someone very close by and enjoying their sake or their karaoke or whatever. So one of the things that really surprised me in coming back to Toronto is you know, how much space and how much quiet, you know, Hanami really wasn't, I came back 25 years ago, but Hanami wasn't, it wasn't a popular thing here in Toronto. So I kind of got to wander out into Hyde Park where a lot of people necessarily enjoying their sort of Hanami picnics under the trees. There are people there looking at them, but it was a very nice experience.
I guess from when you came back to Toronto till now, I guess what's been the biggest change with Toronto's viewing of the sakura blooming?
Well, I think a lot of it too is that, you know, there's been a lot more effort. There are either the consulate, private individuals, to create sakura spaces at different parks around the GTA. So I think there's a lot more sakura to enjoy. I think that's very significant. So not only has the awareness increased, but also access to beautiful spaces filled with sakura have increased as well exponentially, I would say, in the last. If it's something that your listeners haven't done, I would strongly recommend going out and having a Hanami party with friends or simply wandering under the tree, a Hanami experience. Very, very deeply connected to Japanese culture, and it's certainly something that anyone can I think, enjoy deeply.
Thanks, Thompson. And to close the show, we now head on to Wheaton's All-in-One Redemption Center in the Sackville Industrial Park to see how they are faring with the new rules that make consumers eligible to get back a full deposit on beverage containers. That's because since April 1st, New Brunswick consumers who return their beverage containers have been getting their full deposit back, doubling the couch. That means that in the months leading up to the change, people were holding back, waiting for refund increase. Darren Whedon says volume have doubled April 1st, but he's waiting to see what will happen to redemption levels before making any increases to the staff. On location in Brunswick,
the cans and bottles have been piling up quickly this month at Wheaton's All-in-One Recycling Depot in the Sackville. And April 1st, consumers who return their beverage containers have been getting their full deposit back, doubling the cash payout on a bag of cans and bottles. That means that in the months leading up to the change, people were holding back, waiting for April 1st. CHMA dropped by Wheaton's to find out how the depot is faring now that New Brunswick has embraced a full deposit return.
Hi, I'm Darren Wheaton, the owner of Wheaton's All-in-One Recycling and Redemption Center, I guess.
All right. So April 1st was a big change.
Yes.
What did you guys notice the first couple weeks here?
Well, you know, it's like a lot of people are holding off bringing in their bottles to the cents, or extra nickel, sorry, because it went up to 10 cents. So a lot of people were holding that for the last 2 or 3 months. And so then they all, of course, come in at once. And as you can see, we're a little backed up.
Did you? Yeah, there's a lot of bags out front here and everything.
Yeah, I mean, some of that's because we ran out of bags to sort them into, which they're coming tomorrow, so they do fall. That put us behind 3 days, I guess.
Yeah. Was it logistically challenging to, you know, have people be holding off for those 2 or 3 months? Like, were you, did you notice a big, I guess, gap in your...
So like, definitely the sales, I guess, were down. But, I mean, we knew that they would be up again in April, so it's been... try to budget.
I guess you've out, yeah. You know, you're of course getting the same, I mean, are you're getting the same amount when you bring those back, right?
Yes. Yeah. We still get the same percentage. I think we're getting a small raise, but it hasn't gone through yet, but it's like, you know, 16th of a cent type thing.
What kind of numbers did you see come April 1st?
Probably 3 times the amount that we normally would get, almost post-COVID levels. And but
so, and then how, like, you know, I guess how many thousand cans do you get?
About 80,000 cans a week, 80 to 100,000 cans. Now, before this, it was maybe 35, 40. It varies too, depending on what's going on.
So you expect that will go down now?
I've give it another month or so. People get used to it and everyone falls back into their old habits.
Yeah. One reason they might be doing it is to actually increase the amount that people return as opposed to throwing away.
Yeah, that was the idea behind it, for the government anyways.
Yeah. Do you think it's having an effect?
It's hard to say, like I said, right now, because of most of our stuff we feel is coming in just because everyone is hoarding it for a while. If it's actually increased for maybe once we get through this rush of stuff.
All right. Give people an idea of what the rate changes were.
Well, basically everything went up a nickel. So now you get your 10 cents for pop bottles and cans. Pop cans, wine bottles went up. The general wine bottles, like anything over 501 milliliters, is now 20 cents for glass. But everything else is 10 cents. So I guess.
That's Darren Wheaton of Wheaton's All-in-One Recycling on Industrial Drive in Sackville. Although it will deposit a benefit to consumers, it turns out it's not as much of a boon as it seems. Under the old system, the half of the container used for two things: to cover the handling fees for the containers and to fund the province's Environmental Trust Fund, which spends $8 to $9 million per year on environmental programs like watershed monitoring. The province of New Brunswick has not announced how it will replace the funding for the Environmental Trust Fund, but there is a system in place to cover handling fees, container recycling fee, which is completely non-refundable. In some cases, the new recycling fee will actually be higher than the increase in deposit return that consumers get as of. And unlike the beverage deposits, the container recycling fees will not appear on store receipts. In fact, in an agreement struck with the province and industry group NCOR, which operates the program on behalf of producers, the new container recycling fee cannot appear on receipts and must be included in the product price.
And that's it for us at Viewpoints. Our journalists this week were Pamela Hassan, Owen Thompson, and Erica Butler. Our national editors were Maureen McEwen and Victoria Fenner. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassin. Thanks for time to stay with us this week. And until the next, ciao. Nationwide.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
Here's the song about cheese, please. The music's silly, gonna get what you need. Celebs who thought they could sing. Crazy remakes and Seacrest wouldn't. Anywhere else, these songs would be teased. But we love them for their quirks, and so will you on Cheese, Please, Please. Oh, yeah, it's Cheese, Please.
Cheese, Please. Here are your hosts, Snarf Dude and Daffodil.
Thank you, Mr. Announcer. It's another edition of Cheese Please. My name is Snarf Dude.
And that means I'm Daffodil.
Bringing you the wacky, warped, and weird every week as we hang out here in the bunker, watching TV, digging out the cheese, and other lazy things as we watch out and take care of all the vehicles here in the bunker before their owners come.
They're coming.
Yes.
I hear there's a pickup party happening.
Really?
Yes.
Oh.
They asked me to bake a cake. That's how I know.
I see. And you're going to do that.
Oh, of course.
Oh, huh. Yeah. Okay.
I get much better tips if I bake a cake.
Really?
Yes.
Oh. Does anyone have to wash and wax?
Oh, no, no, no. The cars are clean.
Okay. I thought we'd have to call Mr. Miyagi.
No. Cars are clean. Wax on, wax off. No.
Good. Good. I just want to make sure on that one. Anyway, on the show this week, we're going to get a little tipsy. Well, not really. Not really. Some of the songs, maybe. Songs of the man of no distinction. We drink along with Irving. I know. No, I said, yeah, it's an album, okay?
I know, and I'm laughing because you said night traps instead of night caps.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
Because you think liquor is a trap, so I get it.
As well, in the celebrity slip-up, you may not know him, but man, I'll tell you a little bit about Burn Hamilton as his character of Captain Beyond the 1970s television series Starsky and Hutch. He cut an album, he cut a record,